It's the Armageddon edition of Radio Freethinker. This week, Norwegian Terror, National Debt, and interviews on the neurobiology of magic. Let's begin episode 126.
And welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
And this is Daniel, economics student and back on Radio Free Thinker.
Jenna, your friendly neighborhood biochemist.
Wow, what a week we've had. What a week we've had. I was really confused when I was doing my Science Sunday blog. I was quite confused at two articles I saw. One was the long-term prospects for the International Space Station, and the other one was how they're planning to dunk it in, like, 2015. And I was quite confused by
that. Well, that sounds like long-term plans.
Well, yeah, but I mean, like, once we're up there, why would we not, like, just keep it up there? It seems so...
Well, decaying orbit. It'll fall down on its own, won't it?
No, you keep pushing it back up into the higher orbit.
And it probably costs a lot of money to keep it up there.
Yeah,
we all know NASA doesn't get much money anymore.
Yeah, I remember hearing something about, like, billions and billions and billions of dollars or something, so.
I saw one, I'm going to call it news article, then I'll tell you where I heard it.
About going to call it a news article?
Well, it was about a parade in Moscow proclaiming the triumph of the Soviet space program over the American space program because it's now still able to go into space and the Americans aren't. Of course, this was from The Onion, so.
I don't think that counts then, actually.
Well, that's why I said I'm going to call it a news story.
I was going to say Soviet parades happening still would be a little weird.
Yeah. Wait, I thought they were America's best news source. Did I miss something?
Yeah, you did. It's the joke at the end of the episode, of the segments. But speaking of something that is not a joke, Daniel, I understand that besides no longer
not
having...
Not being a joke...
Thank you. I appreciate it.
No longer have enough money to support any sort of space program at all, and selling off the gold and silver and the China, the Americans are apparently having some issues with money.
Yeah, maybe they could sell the space station to China, and that would bring in a little bit. So you may have heard, if you've at all seen the news lately or watched The Daily Show or appeared onto the internet, that there's a huge crisis going on in the U.S., or at least, according to lots of people, there's a huge crisis going on in the U.S. If you remember, today, August 2nd, is the day that the U.S. Treasury Department said that it was going to run out of room on the debt ceiling, and that's a sort of arbitrary limit that is decided by the U.S. Congress for the total amount of debt the U.S. can have. So a last-minute deal was made to save it, so rest assured, if you're supposed to get a check from the government, you're still going to get it today. That's the U.S. government. But what was going on with this debate? Is there actually anything to any of this?
Well, first of all, I'm curious to know, how many times has this debt ceiling been raised in the past?
Many, many times. I think it's like 40 or something. I could be wrong.
No, it's about right. And normally it's just a normal sort of accountancy sort of thing. They just do it as par for course. But one of the things that was interesting about this is that suddenly the budget has been introduced into this because people who have trouble with the amount of money the Americans borrow usually have that fight over the budget, whereas this has all been about raising this debt ceiling.
Yeah, it's true. Usually it's a separate thing. You'll get sort of no votes on it as sort of we don't like the current government, but it's never a serious threat. I think it was raised almost like 8 times during George Bush's junior's term, and never once did it even come close to failing.
So the debt ceiling, a little easier to raise than the glass ceiling.
Anyways,
Sorry. I should point.
Suddenly, I'm feeling my ovaries a lot in this room.
I was going to say, actually, we shouldn't laugh at that. It's a very serious issue.
Yes. The first thing I wanted to look at is how much debt does the U.S. actually have in comparison to other countries? So, Japan is the highest of countries that haven't defaulted. They have 220% debt-to-GDP ratio. So that basically means if everything their country made for 2.2 years was spent repaying the debt, they could pay it off. To give you an idea, Canada is in a much better position. They are at 34%. So we'd only have to give up like a third of a year. The U.S. is at 60%. So considerably more than Canada, but way below Japan, and there's no real talk that Japan's in a crazy crisis, even though they had an actual crisis.
Well, and another bizarre thing about this is, because of the way the economy is sort of going, the ability for the Americans, Canadians, and, well, except for the Greeks, to actually raise, to buy the bonds, like, to, you know, you go out there and you get debt, you have to pay interest. The interest rates on debt is at a historical low, that even though the American debt is higher than it's ever been, the percentage of GDP that is spent paid on the interest is lower than it's ever been.
That's very true. You jumped ahead a little bit, but
Sorry. So
as of right now, the U.S. currently pays 1.4% of its GDP on paying off interest. Back in 1997, they paid 3%, so a dramatic increase. Even in nominal terms, not adjusting for inflation or anything, they pay less now than they did almost a decade and a half ago. To give you an idea, Canada, with a lot less debt, actually ends up paying way more, 2.5% of GDP. So by any of these measures, the U.S. is really not in a bad position on debt. It's entirely manageable. Tons of other countries have more and pay more.
What about the connection with China? We hear a lot about China owns all this U.S. debt, and that is being repeated in the media so much. I think it's kind of stirring a bit of panic that China's going to own the U.S. or something.
Yeah, well, debt doesn't really work that way. You never really gain ownership, but China does own a considerable amount of the U.S.'s debt, but more is owned by, I think, Japan. More is owned by, or I think Japan's first, China's second, but there's lots of other countries in there that owe a large amount, or private banks own very considerable amounts. China does not sort of wholly own the U.S. government in terms of debt. It's a big chunk, but not a sort of majority chunk or anything. Mm-hmm. So some other things, like the U.S. Spends only about 10% of its total federal budget on paying interest. So 90% or 90 cents of every dollar that they get in goes to sort of actual programs that do things for people, or send munitions to kill people in other places in the world. But biased a little bit. That's pretty low. Most countries end up paying more. So once again, there's no reason the U.S. should be having this huge crisis over the debt ceiling. They're really not in that bad of a position compared to most other countries.
And actually, to reiterate that, as much as there's been this sort of fear-mongering about the American debt crisis, which, again, seems to be almost a faux crisis, the markets haven't really responded. The only thing you've actually ever heard were the credit rating agencies saying, oh, we're going to downgrade this. But to be fair, in a certain way, they're not unbiased people. Right now, there's a law in the United States that is holding them accountable for the credit ratings that they did on the junk bonds that got the Americans into this big trouble in the first place. And in an odd way, that the these credit ratings have been suspected, and of course, conspiracy theory in that time, of using their leverage now as on the American debt to force the American government to do things it would not normally do.
Yeah, this really weird thing happens in the U.S. The way most of this debt is, it's in short-term treasury bonds. So these are things that the U.S. Treasury loans out at really low interest rates, usually like 1% or less. They're considered basically the safest asset in the world. So whenever anything looks tumultuous in the world, people rush to those and drive the prices down. Right now, the debt ceiling theatrics is causing people to buy more of these, which is basically lowering the price, saying that people feel more safe in them now, even as sort of the debt ceiling shenanigans get worse. It's kind of this sort of funny, like weird feedback circle you get. But there is a bit of a problem there. If confidence does start actually getting lowered, if these rates rise because the U.S. debt is all short-term, well, not all, but a large chunk short-term, they're going to have to pay hugely more in interest if they actually do let this become a problem that affects people. So is there, behind the total amount of debt, is there another problem that maybe people should be worried about? Does the U.S. have a spending problem, as Republicans often like to say? There might be something to that. I'm sure Don might disagree with me here. But if you look at historically in the U.S., since World War II, they've always brought in about 18 to 20% of GDP in tax revenues. They've never really managed to get this above it for long. They did temporarily during World War II, and it's never fallen below it for too long.
Where's your reference for that?
It's one of these references I have here.
Okay.
Congressional Budget Office.
Yeah, I originally found it, but I found it from the Heritage Foundation, which led me to go, uh-oh.
Yeah, this one's from the Congressional Budget Office, I believe. It'll be linked in the show notes. And so spending has always sort of fluctuated around that. In the last 30 or so years, it's almost always been above the taxes being brought in. But it's always been taxes that have been able to be brought in has never... has never gone much above that. Currently, the U.S. is spending, I think, something like 26% of GDP. So if taxes always seem to have a trouble of getting much above 18 to 20%, you can see how it's very hard for you to look at, see a rosy picture for the debt future when spending is quite a bit higher.
And one of the interesting things in this, too, is that if you look at the historical data, when Clinton left office, you actually had a case where they were in a positive situation. And as a good Keynesian, which we all are now, you know that when money's rolling in, that's when you pay off your debts, that's when you do this. But what Bush did was he cut taxes. And then, in a bizarre move, he decided to invade Iraq because they were responsible for 9/11, as we all know. Fox said it so, it must be true. And actually, if you look at the data, as Daniel's kind of pointing out, there's usually like one percentage point or so difference between revenue and expenditures, and they're all kind of close. But about 2001, 2002, there was like 3% or 4% difference, which in itself doesn't seem like a lot. But when you're dealing with trillions of dollars compounded over years and years, it does dramatically inflate.
Yeah. I believe I can say this purely factually. George Bush was probably one of the worst for raising the amount of debt the U.S. had to pay of basically any president since the World War II. Even Obama, you can't really blame all of it on him because the sort of the fiscal policy he basically took from Bush when he was getting in. So it's not current administration problem. It's been a problem in the U.S. for a long time. Mm-hmm. And under the best estimates, so these are by Obama's administration themselves, spending is never going to fall below 22%. But without policy changes. On the current road they're going, 22%. And with that includes tax decreases that lower the amount they're bringing in to about 18%. So you can see how going into the future, something has to change.
And I think the biggest issue here, I have a great quote here by FDR, which I found a few days ago, which I loved. FDR had said, and this is 1932, that as society becomes more civilized, governments, nations, and states and locals are called upon to assume more and more obligations for its citizens. The privileges of membership in a civilized society are vastly increased in modern times. Of course, there are some in our society who do not recognize or avoid their duty to pay. And really what a lot of this has been about hasn't been so much a tax battle, but who pays the tax battle, right? Grover Norquist was famous to say that he wished government to shrink so small that you could drown it in the bathtub, right? And I think there is issues about debt. There is issues about spending. But a lot of it just has to do about who is willing to pay for society. And in the United States, we are seeing a battle that's going to be going through in Canada, I'm sure soon, where you just have a right-wing fundamentalist sort of group who's saying corporations are good and people don't matter. And I'm just going to keep going on if you don't call me a rant. She's so
Dad,
out of it.
You're so ranting.
Okay. Maybe we should end this part. Daniel, do you have anything last to say on this?
I just want to say some good news if you're Canadian. We're in a much better position. Our deficit is not nearly as bad. And despite the Harper government lowering taxes to unsustainable levels without some change, we're okay for a little while at least.
Well, that's good for a little while. Let's go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver. Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts on Commercial Drive at Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore. You'll also save online at Band March Canada and Big Mama. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Don, you're going to tell us a bit about the double standard of terror.
Terrorism in Norway that has left over 70 dead and almost 100 injured. We've talked before about the growing sense of xenophobia that's gripped Europe. And for those who thought that this sort of traditionalism would lead mainly to things like racism or discrimination, may feel shocked at the overt violence that what I think this line of thinking inevitably leads to. There's been a lot said about this incident, and we'll attempt not to repeat ourselves too much. That said, there are a few points that I thought should be clarified and some interesting observations that could be made. First, a number of people have questioned the fact, is he a Christian fundamentalist terrorist? To answer this question, we have to take a look at each three claims. I mean, is he a terrorist, is he a Christian, and is he a fundamentalist? According to the dictionary, terrorism is defined as, quote, seriously intimidating a population or unduly compelling the government to perform or abstain from performing an act, to seriously destabilize or destroy a fundamental political, constitutional, economic, or social structure of a country or an international organization.
I think it's pretty clear his intent was to destabilize the country, to try and push towards his idea of thinking. I think he's pretty clearly a terrorist.
Yes, actually, and by his own things. He was intending to bring down the quote-unquote Marxist order in Norway. And actually, one thing I thought was surprising that we often think about, it doesn't really matter the number of deaths that were involved in this, right? I mean, it's only the actual intent of it. In this case, it's sort of a Kantian sort of thing. For those who don't know, Kantians don't worry about the outcome, only the reasons for doing something. So, yes, I mean, he wanted to compel the government to expel all Muslims, to return to a culturally pure Europe. So you're right. In my books, he definitely qualifies as a terrorist. But was he Christian? According to his blog, he said, I wasn't particularly religious. Then I sort of glommed onto Christianity, and I realized I had to have a Christian identity. And it's true that in his blogs, he did criticize Protestantism, but it wasn't a criticism of religion itself or Christianity, but because he thought this was part of the quote-unquote cultural Marxism that had inundated Norway and Europe itself, and that it had somehow allowed for the purity of Europe to be thinned.
I've got a question, Don. Is that a translation? Was that originally written in English? Just wondering who came up with the word glommed on.
Yeah. Well, actually, that's a good thing.
I think it changes my opinion of whether or not his beliefs are particularly strict. Sort of strident.
Well, according, and we're going to get sidetracked here a little bit, and I don't really want to, but there are conspiracy theorists out there now who say that this guy had his blog out there, and English, because it's international language, a lot of blogs, even by foreigners, are done in English. But they had said that he had a Norwegian blog, Norwegian Facebook page, up until the day of the incident, and then the day after the incident, it had been changed.
And is that there this was, any evidence of this?
No, again, this is just sort of one blogger making an assertion about this. But I am sure...
That one blogger does realize Google caches sites, and so you should theoretically be able to find this if it's true.
And actually, this was part of the thing about saying, well, he wasn't identified as a Christian before the incident, but suddenly afterwards it was part of his Facebook identity. But I mean, you know, like I say... He did call for a return to a more Catholic-type church. He even stated that he had high hopes for the current pope with what he thought was an initial hard line against Islam. If we all remember, Pope Benedict had done a few, and people are calling faux pas, where he did quoted some medieval Christian speakers who said Islam is bad and we got to fight Islam, and he didn't mean it, well, apparently he didn't mean it in a negative context, he was just quoting this historical figure. And later he came on, he had to apologize, oh, whoops, no, I wasn't trying to feed the racism that's rampant in Europe, whatever. And actually, by his apologizing, that actually sort of made our perpetrator think that the Pope wasn't actually good, because he did have a conciliatory attitude. So again, in his own words, he claims to be a Christian, that he had a personal relationship with God. He wished to reinstate a Christian crusade based on the Knights Templar in order to purge Europe of this disease of Islam, as he would term it, not my term, his. So again, I mean, a lot of Christians are trying to step away from this, but I think, again, he qualifies as a Christian in almost any sense that you can think of it.
On the other hand, I mean, I can call myself a horse.
You can?
I can.
Yes, but if you call
Ethan, I'm a horse, and I identify as a horse, but I'm not sure if the equine community would agree with me.
No, but if you sat there and suddenly put a cart on your back and started walking down the road...
Again, I'm not sure the equine community would agree with me.
Well, actually, you know, and it's funny, because there's some parallels to this, because when you have, quote-unquote, Muslim terrorists... The Islamic community rushes out and says, this isn't real Islam, this isn't real our beliefs, right? So again, this sort of circling the carts to defend yourself against these claims, one, seems a bit disingenuous, because, I mean, you're quite willing to claim anyone as a member of your camp until they do something bad. And then once they do something bad, it's like, oh, no, he's not a real thing. In fact, philosophically, we have the no true Scotsman fallacy, which plays right into this, right? So, again, I think he does qualify, at least as a self-identified Christian, and whether this means that we should take the next step and label all Christians as terrorists is something we'll discuss a little later, because that does seem to be one of the double standards that we hold. But, okay, so far we agree he's a terrorist, we agree that he's at least a self-identified Christian, but is he a fundamentalist? Ah, because this fundamentalist term has been thrown out a lot, too. And this gets a lot more complicated, because we, in North America, tend to think of fundamentalism as our evangelical Bible literalists. I mean, we have a very strict sense of someone, they have to be a young earth creationist, they have to believe that homosexuality is evil, they have to all these sort of things that are wrong. And although he did have a weird thing where he thought women were sort of a weaker sex, in the sense of they have more sexual capital, and therefore must be somehow protected or put off on the side. He seemed to be someone who's a misogynist. And he based this, bizarrely enough, that him and his buddies traveled Europe and seen how many women in each country they could get a one-night stand for, and used that as a metric to determine how, what's the word? Corrupt, not corrupt, but decadent the society was. And it just, it's... So, anyhow.
No comment.
Yes. So, but that being said, he did believe that the current church had sort of lost its way and that it needed to return to a more authoritarian, more traditional role. That its creed of tolerance and multiculturalism is what he blamed on the problems that were hitting Europe. That the new church and these creeds had put Europe on the precipice of being destroyed and turning it into a fundamentalist Muslim caliphate. So in that sense, I think you could say that he's sort of a fundamentalist. I mean, one of the things about fundamentalism, as far as its technical definition, is to return to the pure source. And in that sense, he wants to return to a pure source.
Or at least what he understands to be that pure source.
Exactly. But I also think that we can look at this in another way. Fundamentalism can also apply to his racial views. So if we interpret each one of those as sort of a descriptor, that he was a terrorist, that he was a Christian, and that he was a fundamentalist, and not a Christian fundamentalist, but just a fundamentalist, as three sort of degrees of dimensions of description, I think he also qualifies as that, because, I mean, it seems quite obviously that his views on the racial purity of Europe are what we would consider fundamentalist views, very radical, very back to the Scandinavian, Norwegian, Viking sort of play.
And very black and white.
Very, very stark. Us versus them. So I guess we can sit there and say that we could, in some ways, call him a Christian, fundamentalist, terrorist, and maybe even an extremist, because, again, it's hard to say that his views weren't really extreme. But then we have to look again at the whole meaning of this. I mean, the term itself, you know, fundamentalist terrorism, is a relatively new one. We've always sort of had terrorism. Terrorism isn't a new thing. But often in the past, it wasn't a Christian terrorist or Muslim terrorist or whatever. It was political terrorism, or it was, you know, economic terrorism. And the importance of having that political terrorism is it provided a context for why the action was done, as opposed to just labeling it as bad and ignoring the entire context. We see this in, like I say, in the 1800s, 1900s, you had anarchists who were famous for their terrorist actions. They wanted to bring down the government. They were full-thing terrorists, and they would kill people, they'd blow bombs. But it was always seen as a political act and an effort to sort of destabilize the government, and it wasn't seen as labeling an entire group. I mean, just because you were a leftist did not necessarily mean you were a terrorist. Whereas the new terms that we're using to describe terrorism, by calling it a Christian terrorist, by calling it a Muslim terrorist, which of course is the most obvious one, is somehow labeling anyone who is a Muslim is automatically a terrorist. It eliminates the context for it. I mean, let's take a look at 9/11. I mean, 9/11 was sort of an attack by Muslims on the West. Yes. Was it a religious one? No, it wasn't really religious. It wasn't religious really at all. I mean, yes, Osama bin Laden and all the ones who supposedly had interacted were inspired by Islam, but what they wanted were political gains. They wanted to get the Americans out of Saudi Arabia. They wanted to...
If you look at it, Osama bin Laden, I suppose had is the right word to use now, a very specific mission for what he was trying to accomplish with 9/11 and other terrorist attacks. You can find it on his Wikipedia page. I will look at it. Very political. It's not really religious. It might use some religious language to sort of gain support, but it really is a political document.
And that's where you get into the thing. I mean, even the other ones, 7/7, the Madrid bombings, were all political acts. They weren't religious acts, yet we apply this religious label. And that, again, is where we're getting sort of a different context into it. I mean, I found it was actually quite hilarious in a way, and I don't mean hilarious as in funny, hilarious as in bizarre, that when the Norwegian attacks were first publicized, there was just this rush to say it was a Muslim attack. We just automatically assumed that, you know, I remember seeing one thing, Norway's 9/11, Islamic jihadist attack capital, right? And it was just like, it was so bizarre, this knee-jerk reaction to it. When actually, if you go by and you take a look at it, relative to any nation, Muslim attacks are relatively small. The reason why we have this heightened perception is that, one, our media tends to mention a lot, and you also get the thing about a lot of the attacks in, like, Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq are going to involve Muslims because that's what the indigenous population is. When actually, if you take a look at the Well, I'll save a little bit more of this until after a small break. But the one part I thought was interesting, that it was all Muslim terrorists, until they realized that he was a white Norwegian. Then suddenly he became a lone wolf, a crazy person who needed mental help. There was just this whole, it seemed impossible that a white person could be a terrorist. They were crazy, there was something wrong with them. And there's just this instant acceptance that if you're brown, you're part of this Islamic conspiracy to take over the world.
What I thought was interesting was how when they initially were reporting on this attack as, oh, this has got to be Islamic terrorism, as soon as they found out that it was Christian terrorism, the narrative shifted from, Islam is so bad, to, oh, those Christians are so persecuted. And they didn't go from, Islam is so aggressive to Christianity is so aggressive. They went from Islam aggressive, Christianity, oh, persecuted. It was a complete... They just couldn't grasp the fact that Christians can be fundamentalists, can be terrorists, and can do horrible things.
Yeah, what's bizarre, too, is I went and I took a look at the FBI's Most Wanted page, and every terrorist on there is a Muslim. And it's only if you look at the page a little bit and you scroll down in small print, you see a category called domestic terrorism. And then if you take a look at there, and they have like about half as many people, but they're like environmentalists, communists, or blacks. And again, some racialism going on there. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There's this sort of double standard that's being applied, that if it's a Christian, and if you call them a Christian terrorist, you're somehow labeling proper people badly.
You know, the other thing that I've noticed about this story is sort of what's not getting reported. And one of the sort of trends that I've seen is Norway's reaction towards the terrorism. The Norwegian Prime Minister has refused to treat this event as a military matter, like the war on terror. He's considering it a police matter, something that needs to be dealt with by law enforcement. And I have a quote from him, Jan Stoltenberg, and he said that Norway is going to have a more open, a more tolerant society than what we had before, as opposed to we're going to be cracking down on airports and et cetera, et cetera. This is not getting talked about in mainstream media. This is not getting talked about, as far as I can see, in many forms of media, that Norway's plan in dealing with this problem is not to descend into an Orwellian nightmare, but to assert the values they already consider integral to their daily life. Now, the other interesting viral story that I've seen repeated over and over again is the rescue of 40 teenagers from the lake around the campsite where the murders happened. And the reason why people are assuming this story is not getting reported on is that the rescuers were a married lesbian couple who were on the opposite side of the lake when the attack happened. And so the question is this story being marginalized because they were a married lesbian couple? That's what a lot of gay activists are suggesting. Now, I have noticed that there hasn't been really any reporting at all of any rescue attempts, regardless of whether they were gay or straight. So this could just be a smaller track of this larger missing element. But nevertheless, you look at the way this narrative is being structured, and you look at what's being left out. And it's going to have, I think, pretty long-term consequences when we look back on this 20 years from now.
Well, and there's also I've already started talked about the disavowing of Christian, but there's also the extreme right. If you listen to some of the people on the right who've been talking about the evils of Islam and all that, and how they're saying, well, no, he took what we said out of context, that we had nothing to do with this. And yet again, when you flip it over and you talk about some sheikh who said something somewhere or some mullah, again, we quickly say, oh yes, they're inspiring hatred in others. But when you deal with Europeans who are sort of doing the same thing, I mean, some of the things they say are quite horrific. And again, you wonder why people go to these extreme overreactions. I mean, obviously this bad person who did this is out of bounds, but I mean, when you read things like Islam is a religion of violence, there can be no accommodation, they are trying to destroy us, or that Islam is a Trojan horse in Europe. If we do not stop Islamification now, Arabia will just be a matter of time. I mean, when you hear that sort of thing, right? And let's say at the same time, you've lost your job, right? You're suffering personal things. You will go out and you will lash out at the people around you. This is sort of a natural thing. But there's just so many double standards that are applied here, and yet so many misdirects, Just putting one thing in front of the other.
Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. When we come back, we're going to have another interview from TAM with Dr. Susanna Martinez-Conde and Dr. Stephen Macnick on the neurobiology of magic. Stay tuned for that.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
State of hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. Draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is neurobiologist and authors of Sleights of Mind, Dr. Susanna Martinez-Conde, Dr. Stephen Macnick. Dr. Martinez-Conde is executive member of the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness and editor board member of the Journal of Eye Movement and Research and the ASS's official journal, Psyche. Dr. Macnick is the director of the Laboratory of Behavior Neurophysiology at the Borough Neurological Institute. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So you're the authors of Sleights of Mind, which is about the neuroscience of magic, which leads to the question, what is the neuroscience of magic?
That's a long question. The magicians used, besides a number of special effects and that smoke and mirrors and those kinds of physical effects, they also use a lot of sensory as well as cognitive illusions in which the perception of the audience is very different from the physical reality of what's happening on stage. And those discrepancies, those sensory and cognitive illusions as used for magicians, have important implications for neuroscientific discovery as well as for our everyday lives.
How did the idea for the book and in your research come about?
So we were planning a conference of the Association for the Scientific Study of Consciousness, which is the premier academic group that actually studies how consciousness can exist and how can the brain possibly do it. So it's a mix of philosophers and neurobiologists. And so we said, okay, well, what we'll do, we'll run the conference 1 year, but we'll do it in Phoenix where we live. And they said, well, you know, Phoenix is so hot in June. Why don't you do it in Las Vegas instead? And we thought, well, okay, well, they were looking for some action, but they weren't going to get any less temperature, obviously. So we came up to Las Vegas, and we're driving up and down the strip, meeting with hotel managers and restaurant managers, planning this conference. And we're trying to think, what else can we do, a special event, to bring the public into consciousness research? I mean, it's very interesting, and it's accessible to the public. Why not bring them in somehow? And we're trying to think, you know, part of our research is to study how artists create visual illusions in their visual art. And we're thinking, well, who are the artists of consciousness and awareness? And we just couldn't imagine what that was. But kind of Las Vegas told us the answer, because we were driving up and down the strip, we kept seeing 100-foot tall signs of magicians and Penn and Teller on a bus and Matt King on a mailbox. And finally, we got it. that magicians are the artists of attention and awareness. And not only that, but they manipulate attention and awareness better than scientists do, we quickly realized. And so we realized we had to have a symposium with magicians involved and scientists trying to see what the common ground was. And that really was the start of neuromagic.
Let's elaborate on that term. What do we mean when we say neuromagic?
Well, that's a term that we coined in 2008 in an article that we wrote for Scientific American on these issues. And the term neuromagic basically reflects a two-way form of interaction between two disciplines, which are neuroscience and magic, that traditionally have been far apart from each other, but that have a huge area of overlapping interest.
And can you give us an example of how this overlap manifests itself?
Sure. For example, some of the terms we actually use to describe things are the same, even though we have no, it's just convergent evolution, if you will. So for example, scientists and magicians both think of attention as a spotlight. So the idea is that where you're paying attention in space doesn't have to be where you're looking with the center of your gaze, but where you're paying attention, information is enhanced and everything else is suppressed. Just like if you had a spotlight on a stage, where your vision is the stage and your attention is the spotlight. So that's an example of how that's similar. And we also need to now know what's happening in the brain to cause that. And obviously that's of great interest to magicians as well, because that's essentially their job, is manipulating that thing, mm-hmm. or at least a large part of their job.
And so what are the real-world implications of this research? How will we see it manifested in science and ultimately affect non-magicians out there in the world?
The ways that our brains and our minds are fooled during a magic show are exactly the same ways in which we are fooled in real life all the time. It's not that magicians or scientists have special access to special brain circuits that we don't use for anything else. These are the ways in which we fundamentally process information. So just as we saw a conference today in which about false memories and how you can trick yourself into thinking that something has happened when it hasn't, that plays a big role in magic tricks. And when somebody tells you about a magic trick that they saw even recently, their description of that magic trick is going to be very different from what actually happened on stage. And I'm not talking about the secret methods, but just about the sequence of events as they happened are going to be very different from people's recollection later on. And that is a big contributor to the illusion.
And let's dive into some of the notions in the book. I'm curious about the idea of the illusion of choice, especially when it comes to buying things, as I like to buy nice, cool things for my podcast, like this fancy microphone you guys noticed. How can an astute salesman take advantage of somebody who wants to buy something like that?
Well, in essence, there's a lot of different ways to do it. In magic, they call this forcing. And at least one of the methods used to cause someone to make the wrong choice or to make a choice that they didn't know they made, to put it more precisely. And that's that, for example, when they say pick a card, any card, and later they say that you had a free choice of which card you had, that's obviously not true. And so they control what it is you're choosing at any given time. And one of the ways they can do that is with sleight of hand, but another way they can do that is just by understanding how people make a choice. So, for an example, if you have a deck of cards and you're flipping over the cards and the magician says, you go through that deck one at a time, flip them over onto the table, and stop when you've chosen a card, it's very, very unlikely that a person in front of 1,000 other people is going to count through at 2 seconds per card the entire deck, right? They're nervous, there are thousands of people who are watching them, they want to get it over with as fast as possible. So magicians know that, and they're able to narrow down what it is a person will potentially choose to maybe the first 10 cards, but not the first one. So they've already limited, you know, completely what your choice is going to be just by understanding human behavior and how we make decisions. So that's the kind of thing that that can be done with decision making.
I noticed that your book contains spoiler alerts for revealing magic tricks. How do you feel about revealing the secrets of the magicians?
we put spoiler alerts in our book to meet the guidelines of associations, magic associations that we belong to, such as the Magic Castle in Hollywood or the Magic Circle in the UK. And the basic rule of thumb, the president of the Magic Circle in England puts it this way, that the doors of magic are closed, but they're not locked. So you don't want to give away secrets that people don't want to know. So it's good to give some warning, but if people really want to know, there's nothing wrong with revealing those. And that especially if it serves a wider purpose, such as encourage scientific collaboration and discovery, or alerting society that we really get fooled all the time, and these are some ways in which you get fooled not only on a magic stage, but also every day.
So did you guys have to join these societies of magicians, or were you already magicians to begin with?
So when we had this idea, we had never even gone to a magic show before. So this was a totally new thing for us, and as we were learning, we were meeting with the magicians for about a year before our first initial symposium happened. And as we were meeting with them, we realized that there were a lot of things about magic that are hard to understand unless you were a magician, especially one who was fairly accomplished. And we realized if we were going to design neuroscience experiments using magic, we were really going to have to understand magic at the level of a professional, or at least someone who's practiced significantly. So we took lessons for a year. We put together an entire act of our own that was novel, and we used it as our audition into the Magic Castle, which is the premier club of magicians, where you have to actually audition in front of, in our case, 11, you know, world famous magicians to get in, and we barely squeaked in.
It must have been a bit intimidating.
It was like our thesis defense. Yeah.
And James Randi's often says that it's quite easy to fool PhDs. Have you guys exploited this and fooled your colleagues with your magic skills now?
I don't know if I think it's an open question whether PhDs are more easily fooled than non-PhDs, but a lot of magicians have told us that adults are more easily fooled by children, and this we believe is for two main reasons. First, because adults are going to have strong expectations of what reality should look like, and they're going to be surprised if those expectations are not met, whereas children don't have very definite models of the world. So if something apparently miraculous happens, it's not going to be such a big shock to them. So that's one reason. The other reason is this spotlight of attention that is much more powerful in adults than in children. Adults have the capability of concentrating on something for a long period of time and suppressing everything around it. And children are not so easily able to focus strongly as adults do. So if a magician cannot hold the attention of the audience, then it's much more difficult to manipulate it the way they want it. So my guess would be that if, in fact, PhDs are more easily fooled than non-PhDs of the same age, that perhaps may have something to do with the ability to focus. Perhaps if you have a PhD, it's because you have demonstrated that you can concentrate sometimes on very boring subjects for a long time. So that's something to test.
And magicians are quite good at drawing attention. You brought up the magic wand in your book. They also employ beautiful women to distract you. They employ lights and flashy effects and the whole mythos of their act. So was there a challenge then in trying to separate them from their act, or and just see the core of their performance? Or
well, I think that we're used to doing that kind of thing in science, that we already were cognitive neuroscientists, so it's part of our job to break down seemingly complex behaviors into the component parts that in the brain would be usually fairly simple circuits that are contributing to this. But what was a challenge was to talk to magicians about this and try and have them help us understand what aspects were contributing as parts, because fundamentally they're not scientists, they're artists. And they may be artists who think very deeply about human behavior. They are. But at the same time, they don't generally separate these things out, and they're uncomfortable with the idea, for example, of studying misdirection just by manipulating the attentional spotlight, because misdirection to them is also the story you're telling and the plot line and also the emotions that you're deriving with them and the humor you use at a specific point. And to them, these are all one big jumble of a beautiful effect that someone feels. And mm-hmm. So that was more of a challenge, was to convince them that we needed to peel out certain things and study them one at a time, and then maybe we could add up their contributions in a quantitative way later. So
now when you guys watch an act, are you able to sort of decipher it and spot the distractions and go, okay, I see what he's really doing here?
Sometimes, but when we do, it's more of an intellectual exercise. So it's applying inside knowledge to something that you're witnessing. It's not that our perception is fundamentally different, but that is something that is the same for magicians, from professional magicians, from what they've told us, that they do have the knowledge, but it's not that their attentional and perceptual mechanisms are fundamentally different due to their training. They just have a more of an expertise to decide that if I'm seeing this in front of me with these many elements, it must be that the most likely method is this one.
Certainly we enjoy magic more than we did before, now that we know more about it. I think the same, if you asked an astrophysicist about the sunset before and after their training, I think that you'd find that they enjoy it even more after because of the knowledge that they have watching.
Right. And in terms of science in general, how cued in is science to the lessons that magic can teach us? Is it still sort of a niche area, or are we seeing more and more areas of science focusing on this area?
It's a very new field, but even in the few years in which after this collaboration started, we have seen more interest and more collaborations developing between magicians and scientists to get at issues of common interest. And the reception among the scientific community has been very good, very positive. Just to give you an example, a couple of years ago, we were invited to have the opening event at the Society for Neuroscience Conference, which is the major neuroscience conference in the world, and we spoke about neuroscience and magic, and a couple of our magician collaborators joined us in this panel, and 7,000 neuroscientists were in attendance.
Wow. So where is the scientific impact felt more, in neuroscience or psychology?
Well, I think that psychologists have been studying magic for a long time, for about 100 years, and the neuroscience of magic is now only around 6 years old. And nevertheless, I think some of the impact that's coming out of the research in neuromagic is already, I think, bigger than the impact out of psychology. I mean, psychology is fundamentally the study of human behavior in a very careful way and breaking down the components of it into what we call a black box model of behavior. And that's great. And you know, that's a one-sentence synopsis of psychology, which isn't fair to psychology. But for the most part, neuroscience, on the other hand, is the study of the neural circuits that underlie those black boxes. So in many ways, we work together with the psychologists. They determine what the behaviors are that are interesting, and the neuroscientists determine what's happening in the brain to do that. But that, in my view, is a much more powerful analysis of what fundamentally is happening, and it puts a lot of constraints on how things can possibly work. And so I think that already we're reaping the benefits of the neuroscientific analysis of these things in terms of how this affects the ocular motor system and how it affects attention, and all of these types of viewpoints are becoming much clearer.
We're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinkers, so Dr. Martinez-Conde, thank you for joining us. Dr. Macnick, thank you for joining us as well, and enjoy the rest of town.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's go! You're scaring me! It's only a dream.
Power Chord, every Saturday from 1 to 3 p.m. here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
We're back on Radio Free Thinker, so our thanks to Dr. Susanna Martinez-Conde and Dr. Stephen Bachnick for talking with us at TAM. We're out of time for Let's Go for the show today, so let's go to our skeptical
Ethan,
highlights.
Hold it before you rush off. Did you check and make sure you still had your wallet and your watch after that interview? I mean, they didn't do any sleight of hand on you while you were doing that interview, did they?
No, they were pretty tired, as it was the last interview that I actually recorded at TAM, so it was a pretty low-key affair. But, like I said, skeptical highlights.
Yes, are there any?
Do you have any?
I have one. Isn't that good how we have this banter? So, my skeptical highlight is something called Friday Illusion, which they have something called Shifty Shadow Alters an Object's Path. If there's a website, New Scientist, and on there's New Scientist TV, has this cool illusion. The video shows a ball, actually it's just a round image because it's two-dimensional, that travels across a grid plane. The motion of the ball remains constant, but there is the addition of shadows beneath the ball. This shadow is manipulated so as to give the perception that the ball's path is not constant, but keeps changing, even though the ball doesn't actually, it just keeps moving in the same path. But you look at it and you say, no, it's now bouncing, and now it's rolling, and now it's quite a cool illusion to see. We'll have the link on the webpage, but for those who want to jump to it, if you go to www.newscientist.com/video, scroll down for Friday Illusions, you should see it there. It's really, really cool.
That seems like a very random skeptic highlight.
Well, it goes.
I'm sure it's great, but
It's skeptic in the sense that we always have this perception that we see an objective universe. And this is just one of the times when we sit there and say, everything that we know is a lie.
That's said it. And on that happy note,
I have a skeptical highlight. Tomorrow is Skeptics in the Pub in Kitsilano, Wednesday, August 3rd, 7:30 p.m. at the Billy Bishop Legion. In addition, for anyone who's attending Skeptic Camp 2011, we have a rehearsal event, which will take place at 6 p.m. at the Bishop, an hour or so before Skeptics in the Pub. So if you want to practice your talk or get feedback or ask questions, come by for 6 o'clock and we'll help you out with your presentation.
My skeptic highlight this week is another book. So we learned a little bit about the neurobiology of magic, and I have a book on the magic of neurobiology from one of my favorite authors, Oliver Sacks. I'm currently reading An Anthropologist on Mars. It's a compilation of case studies of some of the amazing things that our brains can do to convince us that everything's okay.
Don just shot down my book, so I have no skeptic highlight.
Well, what was your book? Go on, go for it. We need to be open. Skeptics need to be open for things. And
my book is Islamic Imperialism, A History by Ephraim Karsh. I'm probably saying that horribly wrong. So far, it's good and doesn't come off as biased, although Don tells me that might change.
From my research, he seems to be quite an old-school, sort of hardline Zionist-type person who thinks the Palestinians are so much better off since Israel took over. But that being said, it's an academic work. We should be open as long as we're aware of what we're reading, so don't burn the book. That would be bad.
Well, burning books is always bad.
Yeah.
Well, we're out of time here on the show. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
This is Jenna saying remember, the real world is amazing.
And this is Daniel saying if you live near in the Vancouver area, the weather is finally nice. Go outside.
Yay!